Hey everybody, Kevin Rose here. Welcome back to another episode of The Kevin Rose Show. This is going to be a fun episode because it really is an example of what gets me excited about being a venture capitalist. One of the things that we get to do is we get to see pitches from entrepreneurs that are working on very rough early stage ideas. And sometimes you back these founders and their actual idea, their invention, their technology won't see the light of day for another 2, 3, 5, sometimes 10 years. So in looking at these technologies, I feel very fortunate that I get to try some of this stuff very early on before consumers actually touch it. And one of my areas of interest has always been brain enhancement. What can we do to enhance our brains as we age? What can we do to enhance our performance via our brain? And also to do things like improve memory, which can help with things like language learning. And it seems that there are early indications now that the answer is brain stimulation. That means a device that you put on your head, it applies a small electrical current to your brain and allows your brain to learn new things, to recruit new muscle groups for performance, and do a whole slew of other things. I first became aware of this type of technology a few years ago, and this was very much dorm room days for this stuff, where you would have biohackers that were really experimenting with this stuff and sharing different locations where they would place these pads on their heads and fire off this current into their brains. And it was very risky. Like, I was not going to be the person that was an early beta tester for this stuff, but the technology has come quite a ways and we are finally have really high quality devices that are hitting the market. One of them is called Halo. And I actually have the co-founder and co-CEO, Dr. Brett Wingeier, on the show today. He has a PhD in biomedical engineering, and he was a former principal engineer and clinical scientist at NeuroPace, and he has his name on over 30 US patents. This is a really fascinating conversation because, yes, he does have a product that he sells, and from what I've heard, it works quite well. I actually just got mine. I'm very excited to use it and give it a shot. But we talk about the entire industry. We talk about the different types of devices that are out there, the different types of stimulation that can be applied to the brain. So there's a lot to learn here. And as always, when I have someone on talking about a product, I want to let you know that there are absolutely no paid affiliations or any affiliations at all with the company. I wanted to have him on because he came highly recommended and is a scientist that is building these devices. And I have a feeling that in the next decade or so, we're going to see a whole slew of different devices out there to do things like enhancing memory and language learning, to improving your workouts, or even treating things like depression. So it was a really fascinating interview, and I hope you enjoy it. This is Dr. Brett Wingeier. Brett, I'm excited to have you on the show and talk all things brain stimulation.
Yeah.
This is definitely an area that I paid attention to it for probably, I'd say, the last 4 or 5 years. I've seen a bunch of the kind of do-it-yourself home gadgets. I'm hoping you could shed some light here on this whole world because it's been really fascinating as kind of an observer from the outside, but I've always been scared to try this stuff out. I mean, I've heard stories of people getting burned and I've seen a bunch of kind of Amazon do-it-yourself little kits that are for people that want to solder. Like it seems to be a little bit of a frightening world to me, especially when you're talking about applying the stimulation to your brain. What's the current state of affairs? Like, where are we device-wise, and what is the technology and the studies telling us?
There's a couple parts to that answer, and I'll kind of give you the long-form answer because it's a question that deserves the long-form answer. So the whole technology of transcranial electrical stimulation is at its heart a safe technology. If you look at the levels of electrical current and electrical field that the neurons are subjected to, it's not really a ton more than what the neurons would experience anyway in the brain. It's just you're applying it uniformly to all the neurons in a certain pattern, et cetera. But when it comes down to the kind of engineering nuts and bolts of how do you do that and make sure it works exactly the way it should every time, you know, avoid some of the less frequent, but, you know, certainly important stuff to watch out for, like skin irritation. There's a lot of technology that goes into that. And you know, I'm glad you asked, actually, because this is one of the things that's in my wheelhouse as a biomedical engineer, thinking about is stimulating the body and the brain. There's a lot of process that goes into figuring that out. And a lot of that process just boils down to listing all the things that could go wrong, and then making sure that you engineer what you call mitigators to make sure that that stuff doesn't happen.
in bouncing back real quick to kind of the underlying reason that we're doing this, you mentioned applying stimulation, the neurons receiving that stimulation. Who discovered this first, and what are people applying this for? Like, I've heard it from everything from, you know, better workouts to increased memory to depression. Like, it seems like there's I worry in my mind. I'm like, well, is this just really marketing hype, or what do we actually know?
You know, you're right. It's really important to be very clear on what the technology can do and what it can't do, and what maybe it could do in the future, but there isn't great data for it yet. Stepping back to the history, the field in what you'd call its modern form, it was kind of kicked off in Germany at the University of Göttingen in 1999, if I remember right. And it was a scientist named Michael Nietzsche. And what he and his team realized is if you put a moderate electrical current over motor cortex, you can either mildly excite or mildly inhibit motor cortex. You know, that's the part of your brain that controls your body. And you can see this in action by putting EMG electrodes on that muscle. So, you know, since then, folks have learned more and more about it. You can use this to moderately increase plasticity. Essentially, under the hood, you're helping neurons fire together. And what they say is when neurons fire together, they wire together. So you can essentially accelerate something like motor learning and accelerate the benefits that you get from movement training. With any technology where you get the chance to modulate the brain, there's a ton of potential applications. There's people doing good science in things like everything from cognition to, you know, as you say, depression and chronic pain and stroke rehab. Really getting those out there into the clinical world, that's more of a future project. But for now, what we know is we can moderately increase neuroplasticity by subjecting all the neurons to the same electrical field.
And is this something where it is restorative in that it's restoring function that has since been lost? Or is this, if you took a healthy individual, let's just say in their peak at, you know, whatever, age 18, age 16, and you applied the same thing, is it giving us additional powers, like going above and beyond?
I think it's a little of both. Certainly when we're young, we're all at the peak of our neuroplasticity, and we're able to learn things just like sponges. It's amazing. And as we go on in life, we get less able to do that quite as fast. Although, there's a lot of art and science to how we can do that better and faster, which is a lot of what you and I both think about. But, you know, really the superpower here, whether you're trying to perform at a peak level or whether you're just trying to get more out of the time you have, that's the superpower, because the amount we can train, the amount we can learn, the amount we can do, it's always limited by real life, by needing to recover, by needing to take your kids to school, what have you. So if you can pack a little more improvement into those sessions with the time you have, then you can achieve amazing things. And that's the real superpower here.
So what have you seen in your career in terms of things that have just, blown you away, or you're like, I know this works for, X application? Is it a mild effect that we can expect? Like, what can someone, if they're getting involved in this and they, do their first application, what are they going to get out of it?
Really career long, I've been amazed at the ability of neurostimulation to affect the brain. And, this isn't quite what we're doing at my current company, but yeah, I actually spent most of my career doing medical neurostimulation, making implantable devices for epilepsy, Parkinson's disease, things like that. And I got to answer, when you ask me what's really blown me away, it's been the ability to treat patients with those products, some of which are out on the market now. Now, when you turn to transcranial electrical stimulation, what you're looking at there is it's a meaningful, moderate effect where, let's say you do a training session, you might get 15, 20, 30% more, if, for instance, 20 to 30% accelerated benefits out of that training session. And then if you're training thoughtfully, if you're using good form, then those benefits compound over time.
The training stuff is the one that's the most confusing to me, I think, because it's linking multiple groups of the body, at least in my head, together. When I think about the applications for cognition and, it's you're stimulating the brain, it's right there in the brain. But when you're actually talking about increased athletic performance, how do you break that down for people? How do you explain how that actually works?
You know, there's this thing that we call muscle memory, but it's not really in the muscles. It's in your brain, because it's your brain your brain's controlling your muscles, your brain's controlling your body. And so much of, certainly dexterity, certainly learning skills, even if you're just, doing some fundamental strength or explosiveness thing, like vertical leap, a huge part of your performance there comes down to whether you can coordinate all those muscle fibers to have a perfectly smooth, well-timed contraction. Everything fires at exactly the right time when it's supposed to. And, one data point here that we can point to is, even without neurostimulation, when you first start strength training, a lot of the gains you get in the first couple weeks are actually due to your brain and your motor control systems figuring out how to better control your muscles to get more strength. So you actually get stronger when you start working out long before your muscles can actually remodel and physically get bigger and stronger.
The thing that I've learned here is that what you're trying to say, at least I'm breaking it down in my kind of layman's terms, is that it's not a simple on and off switch. Like when I think about, okay, I'm going to lift, a dumbbell, I think, okay, muscle, lift, go, mm-hmm. Okay, max, I'm done, set it down, right?
Right.
In my mind, I'm just telling the muscle to do that, and then it kind of does it. And I've always thought of that as like, how much glucose do I have in my body? Have I eaten carbs? How much ATP do I have? Mm-hmm. But you're saying it's also whether the brain can actually recruit the muscle groups correctly. Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah. So, if you look under the hood at that muscle, it's not just one big fiber. There's not one neuron that goes down to that muscle and says, hey, biceps, fire. That muscle is made up of thousands of muscle fibers. Each of those muscle fibers, they're controlled in a much more complex way by a whole cable of neurons that comes down to that muscle. So, let's say you don't want maximum output. Let's say you want the perfect contraction. Let's say you're working on your forehand and you're hitting a tennis ball. Well, you want your biceps to contract in a certain way. That cable of neural output tells each of those fibers to fire when they should fire. They cycle in and out to hold the contraction. There's some pretty amazing stuff going on under the hood. And, Kevin, do you have kids? I'm going to make a kid analogy here.
I do. I have two under two, so they're not that old.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, I've got two myself, 4 and 9. When you watch a kid learning to get control over their body or to walk or even just to reach for something, part of what you're seeing is the brain learning to fire everything in exactly the right sequence. And, it's not just firing the individual muscles. It's firing the muscle in the right way to get exactly the right level of output and have that smooth reach or that smooth step or whatever.
Yeah, that makes sense. Where do you have to fire and apply this stimulation in order to get that type of learning to take place? And then you mentioned jumping. What other aspects are you seeing this? Like, are professional basketball players using this to shoot better three-pointers? Like, what can this all be applied to?
Absolutely. Some of the pros are using it and some college players as well. The athletes who use this technology the most and get the most benefits out of it are those who train. They train thoughtfully. They think about good form. They measure their results. There's a huge swath of elite athletes who do that. NBA, NFL, Major League Baseball, PGA, UFC, U.S. Olympians, even the military, Special Forces. A ton of elite athletes. And then, really anybody who is interested in getting more out of the time they have to train, which, that's the real value proposition, not just for the elite athletes, but for the weekend warriors like you and me.
And how long does this actually, the benefits, how long do they stay around for? Is it something once you've recruited those neurons and you've applied it to where that you're getting this new plasticity that it's something that sticks for quite some time, or does eventually find its way back to the same old self?
So durability of effect is what that's called. And so the plasticity sticks around for a little while. Plasticity sticks around it sticks around while you're doing the stimulation and about 40 to 60 minutes after that. But the gains you make thanks to that plasticity, those stick around like any other gains. Now, if you you know, sit on your couch, eat, you know, eating Cheetos for the next year, then, you know, you're going to get less strong and you're going to lose some of that skill. But the gains that you get stick around like any other gains.
That's really cool. Now, would you recommend, actually, this is a question I had, is how do you decide where to apply the current? Like, for example, I've heard some folks talking about certain regions that you apply to for cognition and, say, learning a new language. Mm-hmm. But then you also have other people that just want to play video games better. Like, how do you decide which points and how long to apply it for?
One of the nice things about this technology is that the stimulation itself isn't laser focused. Now, there's a ton of types of neurostimulation that are just pinpoint focused. You know, if you're looking at deep brain stimulation for somebody like with Parkinson's disease, you know, that's been around since like 1997. And you know, it's just pinpoint focused. But for this technology, it's because the skull is very resistive. What you're actually doing is you're casting a pretty broad net over most of motor cortex. And what provides the laser focus is the training you're doing. So, you know, essentially you're stimulating broadly across that whole part of brain. You're making it moderately more likely that neurons will fire together when they fire. But then when you pair that with the training, when you pair that with practicing whatever you're practicing, then you're firing exactly the connections that are the connections that you want to reinforce to make a perfect movement.
Gotcha. Understood. So it's more like you're creating the excitement and the plasticity that is loosening everything up. And then you go in and perform the action and that fires the things that are already loosened so that when they hunker back down again, those are the ones that get the most benefit. Is that a bad way to describe it?
That's pretty accurate. But you know, let me extend that a little bit and say, The whole mechanism of motor learning, you know, your goals when you're practicing something are to develop what you'd call motor synergy, which is the ability to fire all the right stuff at the right time, and motor sequence, which is the ability to string that together smoothly and gracefully. And the way that happens is by increasing the synaptic weights, increasing the strength of any of these synapses, the connections between neurons that let them fire together in exactly the right ways. And when you train, the synapses that fire to yield a successful outcome, those get reinforced. And the synapses that are counterproductive get unweighted. And then the whole, it's a neural network that just constantly optimizes itself. And we're speeding up the rate of that optimization.
When you apply the stimulation and you've heard it being successful to treat depression, are people then asked to do any type of thing like think happy thoughts or like how, what would be the exercise there to make things work?
So first of all, I'll put on the scientist hat and say, you know, for depression, there's been a ton of really interesting research, but just for the record, that's not the product we're working on. Our product's a consumer product. But that said, you know, we're excited about some of the science. So the brain target for depression or cognition for that matter is a different brain target. It's what you'd call the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, which is if you point to your forehead on the left side, kind of right where the hairline starts. Well, depending on where your hairline is, probably right where the hairline starts.
Right.
That's DLPFC. And it does what you'd call cognitive control, which is marshaling some of the other parts of your brain to do what they need to do when they need to do it. And in depression, what the data show is that a lot of individuals with depression have a hypoactive left dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. And that has some follow-on effects to other parts of the brain. And there's a technology out there, transcranial magnetic stimulation, where they come in with an electromagnetic coil. And you sit down in a chair that looks kind of like a barber's chair, and they wheel this device over, and they give you electromagnetic blips, like pap 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 pap, to that part of the brain, and that actually works really well for depression. That's been FDA cleared for about a decade now.
Wow,
which is really amazing. And there's a team at Stanford. Nolan Williams is the psychiatrist there, and you know, there's still research going on in this field. One of the things that they're actually working on is, when this whole field started 10 years ago, everybody started using a certain dosage. That's what the products that are out there that got cleared to do this. You know, it's this series of treatments where you do one a day. Well, it actually took a decade, but this group at Stanford is now, they basically asked the question, well, this works pretty well. Could we make it work better just by giving people a little more of it? And this is neurotech. It takes a while, but the answer seems to be yes. And there's this whole line of research now. Well, you know, what if we give people, you know, if somebody doesn't respond to that, what if we give them kind of two or three or four times the amount of stimulation? Well, you know, surprise, it works better. So electrical stimulation it's a newer field. There've been some really good clinical studies in it, and it's a big kind of part of ongoing research.
Can you describe the different types of stimulation? Because you mentioned the magnetic, and there's direct current, and there's alternating current as well. Like what are the different types that someone could sign up for?
So let me answer that for the electrical side of things first. So transcranial electrical stimulation, which is putting a current on your scalp, where enough that makes its way through the scalp, through the skull, that it affects the brain. TDCS, direct current stimulation, has been around for the longest. And that just means direct current. It's a steady state electrical current of around 1 to 2 milliamps. Now, recently, there's been more work in TACS, alternating current stimulation, which is exciting because when you look at the fundamental mechanisms of the brain for things like learning and attention, there are these oscillations in the theta band and the gamma band, and they're linked together. And TACS, which is just an alternating current, it might be 6 hertz, it might be 40 hertz. With TACS, you can probably activate those oscillations and do really interesting things with cognition. I'm giving you the long answer here, but to wrap it up, there's TRNS, which is transcranial random noise stimulation, which it's not really random. It's a broad spectrum signal. I think everybody in the field is still kind of figuring out how that works. You can do pulsatile stimulation, but really it's TDCS and TACS are the main types of electrical stimulation.
Now, on the alternating current side of things, on the TACS, is that something where you can get closer to the brain's like natural frequency, and that's why it's more effective?
Well, so for cognition, for things like learning and working memory, it's TACS may be more interesting than TDCS because, and it comes back to that theta gamma coupling thing. This is really one of the most exciting developments in neuroscience for the last couple decades has been the whole field starting to understand that, for instance, the way we hold things in our working memory, if you look at a word and then you try to remember that word, or if you look at a phone number and you try to remember that phone number, you've got this theta oscillation, which is 6 cycles per second. You've got these bursts of gamma oscillation, which are faster, 40 hertz and up. And the way your brain is holding that phone number in your memory is by bursts of gamma that are synchronized to the theta, to the slower theta rhythm. And there's a good chance that if when you're trying to remember that phone number, each digit in that phone number is actually represented by a little burst of gamma that's timed against that theta rhythm. So because that's so fundamental, a lot of the best work to use brain stimulation for cognition and working memory has used these frequencies, theta or theta gamma frequencies.
And how far out do you think we are until there's something that's reliable on that front for cognition and memory?
I think it could be as early as a couple of years. There literally could be somebody working on that breakthrough right now. It's probably a poorly kept secret at this point that my company, Halo, we've been looking hard at cognitive stuff. We've got a research program there. Others do as well. And there's really a ton of people looking at this, both on the on the non-invasive side, and there's also been, over the last kind of 5 or 6 years, DARPA actually funded some really groundbreaking stuff at the University of Pennsylvania, where they've actually shown that they can stimulate. If they stimulate with the right timing, then they can help people remember things. And one of the really exciting things this year was a paper got published out of Boston University. Rob Reinhart was the principal investigator there, basically showing if you stimulate with the right timing with transcranial stimulation, you can improve working memory. It was this beautiful paper published in Nature Neuroscience that really kind of nailed this whole thing. Now what we in the field have to do is make some products around that and figure out how to make that better and better.
Do you believe that this is something that is going to have a almost like prescriptive use case where someone that has early signs of dementia, they then go and wear a device like this to kind of reverse or at least hold where they're at today? Or is that just sci-fi?
I think it's more than sci-fi. And if it is, it's one of those things where maybe science fiction has predicted this well. Let me put the scientist hat on and, say that, for the moment, certainly somebody with dementia, you make sure that you talk to your doctor and, this isn't kind of a medical treatment yet. But one thing that's becoming more and more clear is, whether you're talking about dementia or some other brain disorder, or even just wanting your brain to work a little bit differently than it is, it all comes down to connectivity. And another thing you can do with this kind of brain stimulation, this is another part of what the guys at Boston University showed, is if you stimulate two locations at the same time, then you can actually increase the synchrony between those locations. You can make those locations talk to each other more, and you can have some really fundamental effects on brain functioning by doing that. So I think we're going to be amazed by what we see in the next decade.
So give me an example of what you mean by two locations talking and being stimulated at the same time. Are there any particular use cases where that's worked out?
Yeah. So, again, just to be clear, full credit to Boston University for this one. We're all kind of standing on the shoulders of giants here, but what they saw was that if you look at how some of these things are stored in working memory, they took older individuals and they showed them these pictures that had subtle differences in them. And they asked them to essentially look at the picture, remember that for a few seconds, and then they showed them another picture and asked them, well, was it the same or was it different? So they're kind of probing your working memory. Well, to store something like that in your working memory, it takes communication between your dorsolateral prefrontal cortex and your temporal regions, kind of further back above your ear. And that kind of network thing is true of almost everything your brain does, because if your brain is anything, it's the world's biggest and most complicated network. That's one of the reasons it's so powerful. Well, to hold this kind of thing in memory, it takes those two regions. And the stimulation that they found makes your working memory better is when you stimulate those two regions right in sync with each other. And, like you should with an experiment like this, they tried stimulating it out of sync. And, it actually made people a little bit worse. They tried stimulating randomly and it didn't have any effect. They went back to stimulating in sync and it made people better because those two parts of the brain were able to be in better communication with each other.
That's fascinating and also scary at the same time. Like, I would not want to be the person that signs up for that study and they just like scramble my brain. They're like, yep, sure enough, he's dumber now that we actually did this experiment on him. It sounds a little terrifying. That is really cool though. I mean, just the idea that these devices will be used in the future to kind of enhance our memory. As someone that's always had memory problems almost my entire life, it's exciting. Do you know how much of visualizing something is linked to all of this? Like, one of the things I thought was really interesting, I was speaking with Sam Harris about meditation, and he talks about how most people, when they visualize or think of something, can actually make that object appear kind of ghostly, like in their visual, in front of them, actually out in their visual plane. Mm-hmm. But some people just cannot. And I was just wondering, is that something that how you visualize something, is that also linked to memory and recall, or do you not know?
Well, I think there's a ton that we're all still learning, but one data point here is that if you're visualizing a movement that you're making, let's say you're working on the perfect the perfect free throw, and you visualize it. There's some data that shows that you're actually activating a lot of the same neural networks that you would be activating if you were actually sitting there doing the free throw. So, visualization is powerful. One study that I'd love to do at some point is to combine this brain stimulation technology with visualization and watch it in action, and it might make visualization even stronger. Now, everybody's brain is different. There's some people who, they tend to visualize things. Other people are different kinds of learners, but that's also something that can be trained, is the ability to visualize stuff.
And when you say the ability to visualize, do you actually mean, how do you define that? Because it's such a funky term for most people. Like some people, it seems that everyone I ask about how they visualize something, some actually physically see it and some don't.
I think the way I would define it is there's this concept of, I'm going to use the phrase your mind's eye. And again, that's something that might mean something a little bit different to everybody. For some people, if they kind of bring something into their mind's eye, then they might have the sensation of actually seeing it. Others, it might be kind of more abstract. But what you're probably doing under the hood, as a neuroscientist, I kind of go back to, well, what's happening when you visualize something? And what's probably happening is that the networks in your visual system are coming together and firing in some of the same ways that they fire if you're actually seeing this thing. It's not an exact representation. In some people, that's going to give you the sensation of maybe actually seeing it. In other people, it's not. But under the hood, it's your visual system is made up of more and more complicated networks as you get further and further away from the eyes into the deeper parts of the brain. That your retina models things a certain way, then you come back to the lateral geniculate nucleus, a kind of a deep structure in your brain, and it has kind of a more abstracted version of the information. You get back to visual cortex, it's still more abstracted. And then if from there it goes out to networks all over your brain where you hold very abstract things in your mind's eye indeed. So when you visualize something, it's those networks firing, not because you've actually seen something, but because you've asked them to fire in some of the same ways they would if you had seen something.
How about when you apply something like this to meditation, where the object is, I guess it's to not really excite, but inhibit chatter? In some sense, have you heard about any of this applying to that?
Yeah. Well, there's this whole field in its infancy called e-meditation, which is pairing brain stimulation with meditation. One of the places where there's really the clearest data for using this stimulation, for cognitive stuff is things like attention and focus. And again, it's cognitive control. It's your brain's ability to do what you want it to do, as opposed to just kind of going off into whatever it wants to do. And that's really I guess meditation has parts of both of that. Part of it is you want to intentionally kind of have this quiet, still mind. But then depending on what your meditation practice is like, there's also value to your meditation of some of that free association that your mind is doing under the hood. And both of those things can probably be, potentiated by the right type of brain stimulation.
Hmm. And do we know what regions that is? Like, is that something that your device would do today, or?
So our device is for motor cortex. It looks like headphones. Motor cortex is on the part of your head on the part of your brain that's right under the band of a pair of headphones. And a lot of this other stuff is prefrontal cortex. So it's forehead. And again, this is something that we've been thinking about for a while, but it's not the product we currently have out there on the market. So the brain targets are basically, you'd be basically changing the balance of activity of frontal cortex. And it's actually kind of related to what you do for creativity as well. Another really interesting field still kind of in its infancy here is modulating creativity with brain stimulation. And that's a guy named Adam Green's lab out of Georgetown. By dialing up left prefrontal cortex, you can essentially make yourself more analytical. By dialing it down, you can essentially make yourself more able to free associate and generate ideas that might, and then you put the filter on at a later stage in the process where you want to put the filter on. So getting back to meditation, if you increase cognitive control, if you upregulate left dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, then then you should be able to essentially have kind of more focus and more control over what your brain is doing. And then if you want to pivot yourself in the other direction, then you could deliver stimulation that would downregulate left DLPFC.
Yeah, I mean, you're painting this awesome slash kind of a little bit scary. And I say that, you know, I imagine a world where I wake up in the morning, I hit the gym, I stimulate myself. I want to go learn Japanese. I stimulate myself. Like it sounds like, you know, there is a world where, you know, I meditate, I stimulate myself. I want to get a little more creative. I stimulate myself. Do you think there's any downside here at all? I mean, do we know of, is this going to be something where it's like caffeine in a way where we're like, okay, a little bit's okay. But you know, there's a point where you got to just put down the cups of coffee and let your brain rest.
It's like any other kind of training or any other kind of training aid. You know, there's the science does suggest that there's a point of diminishing returns. Like any technology, there is certainly a point where it's not just diminishing returns, but it's counterproductive. I think the field is still understanding exactly when that occurs. You know, a session is 20 minutes. If you do this for two sessions of 20 minutes, you're definitely in the realm of diminishing returns. One of the important things here is it's a real boost to how people train. It's a real boost to accelerate benefits. But the neuroplasticity that results, it's probably not more than what you would bring to, you know, one of your best, more motivated days of training. And it's meaningful when it's combined with high quality training. It's meaningful when it's combined with all the other things that go into, you know, whether it's learning or physical training, you know, finding the right material, measuring your outcomes. You know, if you're bouncing between types of neurostimulation and, you know, treating it as kind of as a technological panacea, then that's probably going to be counterproductive as well.
Right. So what you're saying essentially is that, you know, you still have to put in the hard effort, right? It's not like it's just, this is a magic pill or a magic device that you put on your head and you instantly your IQ shoots up. Like it's, you really have to apply yourself as well then in order to see anything, any benefits.
Right, right. Yeah, it's, you know, if you use it sitting on your couch, you're just going to get better at sitting on your couch. If you use it training with poor form, then that's probably going to be counterproductive as well. One of the hallmarks of, you know, how, you know, what makes for effective training is variety. So the best guidance is to use, and what the science supports as well is to use this thoughtfully. Use it a lot of athletes or musicians would use it in maybe 3 to 5 times a week, paired with their more technically demanding workouts or practices. Measure your outcomes, train thoughtfully, measure your outcomes over the space of a few weeks, and then at the end of that you should be able to see an incremental benefit.
That's great. How about on the sleep side? Have you done anything there? Is there any research that this could actually increase certain stages of sleep, or is that outside of your realm?
It's a little bit outside my realm. It's one of those things where there are some neuroscientists thinking hard about that, and there's probably some promise there, but I don't know a lot of the details. I do know if I could digress for just a second, there was kind of a breakthrough in sleep research that just got some press. It was this realization that one of the things that's happening when you sleep is because of this interaction between neural activity and blood flow in your brain. When you're sleeping deeply, your brain is actually busily pumping out some of the toxins, or I don't know if toxins is the right word, but you know, the precursors of beta amyloid plaques and things like that. Some of the things that cause us neurological problems. So there's a ton of potential there if we can make that happen faster and better with neurostimulation in the future, then, it might be a big picture, not just of sleep, but of kind of overall neurological health.
It's exciting stuff. I've been following a lot of the research from Matt Walker, and he's really, I don't know if you know him out of the Berkeley lab, but, there was one company that he was involved with that was looking at applying stimulation at the right time when you're to increase deep sleep. It's a tricky thing because you kind of have to be in that stage apparently in order for it to detect it and then apply it. Well, this is really cool stuff. I did want to touch and go in a little bit deeper on Halo and learn why you built this device, who your target is, and then why did you choose the kind of sports and athletics as your first kind of go to market?
When we started the company, we came from the world of implantable medical devices. We'd spent most of our careers making, you know, at this company called NeuroPace, where we made and got approved by FDA an implant for epilepsy. And this whole time we were following the technology of transcranial brain stimulation and watching it evolve from a couple researchers in Germany to the point where a lot of labs all over the world were getting really interesting results. And it was fantastic science, but it was fantastic science being done with wires and sponges and beige boxes that sit on your desktop and things like that. And it was a really great opportunity to take this and make a product out of it. We started the company in 2013. We looked around at medical applications and cognitive applications and sports, music, and movement. And when it came down to it, the fact that movement is very quantifiable, the mechanisms were more understood, and also it let us build headphones. And part of the journey here is in taking the leap from a laboratory device to something that you can use without any training and put on your head and it gets to the right place and does what it's supposed to do. And we had to learn a heck of a lot about making headphones. It turns out there's a lot of science to making something that's comfortable and looks good and feels good, but it got us something where you don't look like a nutcase in the gym and everybody knows how to put it on. And it lets us address motor cortex, which is something a lot of people care about.
And when you go to use this device, and I've been traveling, so I haven't had a chance to use mine. I just got the package in a week ago. I'm excited to try it. But the one thing I was curious about is, let's say you go to the gym. You had mentioned earlier that the benefits are active for up to, 30 to 45 minutes after you actually turn it on. So do you recommend kind of turning it on and working out while it's on your head? Or do you go ahead, sit there for 20 minutes, let it do its thing, then take it off and then start those movements?
So you could do either one. If you look at when is the sweet spot, well, it comes on during the stimulation while it's activated on your head and then lasts for about 40 minutes afterwards. So if you like wearing headphones when you work out, then certainly start warming up and then, maybe segue into your tougher training while you still have the headphones on your head and you're getting the stimulation. If you're a diver, obviously that's not going to work. So you maybe use it poolside and then take it off and go up to the diving board and practice your dives. It's also a pretty good sounding over the ear Bluetooth headset. So a lot of people just choose to use it as their go-to workout headphones.
Gotcha. And then on the, let's just say, cardio side of things, because I immediately think of improving my Peloton rides. I do these, pretty intense, either high intensity interval training or longer rides. Have you seen benefits on the cardio side of things as well?
Yeah. And actually there was a good cycling study actually just got published this past year by a research group in Korea that we didn't even know it was coming out. They got some Halo Sport units and independently did the study. And they showed that you could increase time to failure in a cycling task with brain stimulation. Now, when it comes to cardio or any kind of endurance sport, this is one of my favorite topics because I do some endurance stuff. And I was a rower in college and in master's as well. One of the key things about success in an endurance sport, if you're a cyclist, you probably appreciate this as well. One of the things that it really decides whether you're going to succeed in a race, for instance, is being able to hold your form in the face of fatigue and pain and discomfort, and that all comes down to your brain. Is your brain able to, do you have it baked in so well that when you're at the tail end of a race or climbing the last hill of the double century or whatever, can you keep your act together in the face of that fatigue? If you can, then you can stay at peak form and you can push through it. But if you can't, the first thing that happens once you start to break form is everything starts to go to hell. You get less efficient. You get more pain and fatigue, and you just get kind of this cascade of endurance sport failure that is kind of a horrible experience, honestly. So the ability to put that off for longer, that all comes down to how well are these movements baked into your brain's muscle memory.
That's fascinating. I do rock climbing a couple times a week, and I can imagine for that where form is essential, that would be another place where I could use this. Do you think mountain climbers, like if you're, I'd imagine if you're going up to Everest, you're facing some of the same situations.
Yeah. Yeah. I've used it for climbing myself. I've done a decent amount of bouldering, wearing Halo Sport before the bouldering session. Certainly felt like it was substantially improving my form. And, you know, like I said, my ability to keep my act together. Actually part of the backstory of the company here is my co-founder and I, we talked about starting Halo on a lot of climbing trips in the years before starting the company. We did a ton of multi-pitch together. And one of the best ways to figure out whether you want to start a company with somebody is to see how they react when you're 15 pitches up and it's pitch black and somebody just dropped their headlamp.
Yeah, no doubt.
It's good times.
That's awesome. One more question I was curious about is someone that tracks all of this stuff, especially when it comes to brain performance, outside of stimulation, is there anything that you personally do, any supplements that you take for optimal brain health that that you'd like to share?
Not supplements so much as just getting enough sleep. It's been an ongoing journey for me. And I spent decades of my life being one of those people who, I go around telling myself I didn't need sleep. And I think it's easy to confuse being able to function well on little sleep with little sleep actually being kind of acceptable or good for you. And, so I don't always do it successfully. And some nights I gotta work until 2:30 or whatever. But, I've been on a journey toward appreciating sleep and just realizing how darn more functional I am when I get enough sleep. And that's been the biggest win for fitness and, neurological health and just kind of feeling with it and alive, engaged for me is just getting enough sleep.
Yeah. That's also something that I overlooked. I feel like in my 20s and part of my 30s, I was just, always pulling those late night kind of all nighters. And you look back on that and you're like, how much damage I probably did.
Right. Right. And it's kind of a rush too. It's kind of exciting and you get that feeling that's 4 a.m. and I'm pushing through. And
right.
I got this done. And oh man, it's counterproductive at the end of the day.
Yeah, no doubt. Where can people learn about Halo?
They can check out our website, www.haloneuro.com. We've got a ton of stuff both on athlete partners and the underlying science. We've got more scientific papers than you would ever possibly want to read. Check us out, haloneuro.com.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, Brett. And you came highly recommended to me. Adam Ghazali over at UCSF.
Oh, fantastic.
When I asked him, he's one of my neuroscientist friends that has his own lab over there. And mm-hmm. I asked him about some of the different devices that are out there. And he's like, oh man, you got to check out the Halo. So
cool.
he came highly recommended.
Awesome. Well, Adam's one of the guys out there doing some of this groundbreaking stuff. And if we're seeing amazing things a decade from now, he'll have been a big part of it.
All right. That's it for this show. I hope you enjoyed it. But before I let you go, I want to tell you a little bit more about the Jordan Harbinger podcast. All right. I wanted to take this quick break to talk about another one of my favorite podcasts, the Jordan Harbinger Show. Jordan, you're here with me. Thank you for being on for this quick little segment.
For sure.
I wanted to plug your show again, because I think you have an awesome show where you go really deep with your guests. So deep so that you actually create these worksheets that have practical advice of every guest that you do, which is awesome. And I know you just had Dennis Rodman on. What was that like?
So Dennis Rodman, that guy's a freaking phenomenon, as you might imagine. I mean, this was an interview where I walked in and he's doing an IV drip, which is kind of your department, right? He's doing an IV drip during the show. And I'm like, what are you doing? He's like, oh, I'm getting some vitamins and some NAD. He's abused his body in a lot of ways. Yeah. So
that NAD IV drip can make you really nauseous. Was he nauseous at all?
So he was very strange. And my crew was like, is he okay? And I was like, yeah, I don't know what. So I go, what's in the drip? And he goes, NAD. And I'm feeling a little effed up right now. And I was like, that explains a lot. Because he was pretty standoffish. And then after a while, we warmed him up and he was starting to like yell at Donald Trump a little to let me back into North Korea. And then because I was actually in North Korea at the same time as Dennis Rodman. So we riffed on that for a while. I actually saw him there, which is crazy. And then he's talking about a little bit of biohacking stuff that he's doing. He's talking about how he was such a character back in the day and what was going through his head. I mean, this is a guy who has some to put it politely, some mental health stuff going on, but is a fascinating, fascinating guy and is actually really, really smart in his, I'll say in his own way. He's a very smart and very talented guy. I mean, he's one of the guys, the best players to ever play the game. He's in the Hall of Fame, and yet he didn't even really play basketball until college, which is insane. So
that's crazy.
It was a literally insane interview for many different reasons. And that was one of my most memorable just because, I mean, who does an IV drip during a show, for God's sake?
That's nuts. Well, that's, I got to go check out that episode, and you can get a link to this episode in the show notes and then also in the description here. But where can people find you online if they want to go and subscribe to the show?
Sure. The Jordan Harbinger Show, just like it sounds. Jordan and Harbinger are luckily both words in the dictionary, and you can find me in any podcast app or at jordanharbinger.com.
Awesome. One of my favorites. Thanks, Jordan.
Thank you.
All right. That is it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Follow me up on Instagram at Kevin Rose there for all my latest and greatest stuff. And if you have a moment, hop on over to the iTunes store and give us a 5-star review under the podcast, The Kevin Rose Show. And that will help us get better guests and get recommended to more people. Thanks so much. Take care.